From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with writer Erica Jong. Her novels Fear of Flying and Serenissima have been inspired by the feminist movement. Also today, I talk with playwright Adrienne Kennedy. Her memoir, The People Who Led to My Plays, recalls her childhood as a black middle-class girl yearning for a life in the arts. Singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne stop in to share a few old songs that have aged well. And Ken Tucker reviews the new home video called The Masters of Comic Book Art. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. With me now on Fresh Air is poet and novelist Erica Jong. She's best known for her first novel, Fear of Flying. In that 1974 book, Jong introduced us to Isadora Wing, whose quest for emotional and sexual fulfillment caught the spirit of the times. It was one of the earliest popular novels to grow out of the feminist movement. In Fanny, a novel published in 1980, Jong's work took a historical twist. The novel turned on the question, what if Tom Jones had been born a woman? Her latest book is a novel set in Venice. It's titled Serenissima. The heroine is there to judge a film festival and is also about to star in a film based on The Merchant of Venice when she travels back in time and has an affair with Shakespeare. Erica Jong, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The main character in your novel, who's an actress, complains toward the beginning of the book that she's in her early 40s, and she complains that that whole area in between your 40s and your 60s when you're a woman is a no-woman's land. What does she mean by that? Because I think it's a feeling you have, too.
Well, I think that for an actress, I mean, I've picked that métier because it's particularly cruel on the question of age. Being a writer, you know, you can be Agatha Christie and you can be in your 90s and still turn out best-selling novels and be a legend in your own lifetime. But for an actress, the question of age is particularly tough. And so by making my heroine an actress, I've in a way heightened the age question for women. Jessica Pruitt is 43 when the action begins. Even though she looks 34, even though she has no want of men pursuing her, even though she's a superstar and she can be glamorous at any age, she's panicked about getting older because she knows that until she looks like Helen Hayes, there aren't going to be any roles for her. And that when producers find out that she's really 43, they're not going to cast her in anything. And in a way, her situation in Serenissima is the situation of the woman in her 40s in our culture. We are presumed invisible. People always say, but you look wonderful. You couldn't be 40 whatever. And you say, but yes, I am. This is what it looks like. But you look terrific, and your boyfriend seems to be 28 or whatever. It's as if we have entered a kind of no woman's land. And I think it's going to be a very important issue in the next couple of decades because demographically the population is aging.
When you say the... Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's all right. But we are, you know, my generation, which is the baby boom generation, we were born in the 40s, and we are on the cutting edge of the culture in every different way. And those of us who were born during or just after the Second World War are now coming to prominence and running the world. And our issues are the issues that are going to be treated in the media. And our issue is that we're getting older.
When you say that women in their 40s are invisible, do you also mean that they're considered to be asexual?
They're considered to be asexual. You don't see them on the covers of magazines.
Unless they're
savvy.
On Dynasty or Dallas.
Dynasty or Dallas. But you see the apotheosis of Joan Collins as a pop sex symbol is a harbinger of things to come. And I think the reason that you see a 52 or 53-year-old actress become a sex symbol is because the population is getting older. And the people who are sitting home tuning in on their television sets are getting older, too.
How is this affecting you personally? Do you think people are treating you differently than they did when you were in your 30s?
No, I think actually, as a matter of fact, because of the accident of my birth, I am in the forefront of those women who are going to change people's minds about age. In fact, I think we're going to make it possible for you to be sexy when you're 72. I mean,
for me personally?
Yeah, for you personally. I was on a show in Cleveland the other day, and a woman came up to me after the show, and she said, "You're absolutely right about sex. How old do you think I am?" And I said, "I don't know. How old are you?" And she said, "I'm 72, and my boyfriend is 52, and we're still doing it." So that's the kind of confessions I get. But I think, in a way, attitudes are beginning to change. And the piece I wrote in the May Vogue, I think, is an indicator of that.
Well, I think one of the most difficult things in terms of changing attitude to attitudes about age is changing one's own attitude towards one's own aging. You know, we could complain about society and this and that, but even people who have pretty open-minded views about aging tend to stare at themselves in the mirror and look for wrinkles and sagging chins and gray hairs and things like that. Are you trying to reprogram your own built-in prejudices about your own aging?
I don't know if I'm trying to reprogram my own attitudes. What I say in the Vogue piece, I really, really mean. I feel better about myself now than I ever did at any time in my life. That's no lie. And I even feel I look better. And that's no lie. Now, I know that when I was 27, I wrote a poem in Fruits and Vegetables called Aging, in which a woman is staring in the mirror and looking at all her little crow's feet and lines. At 27, I looked about 17, you know. But I feel better about myself now in my 40s than I ever did when I was 27. I feel very much more serene. I feel more centered. I'm better able to take care of myself, both physically and emotionally. I feel a sense of confidence that comes out of liking myself as a person. So I even think I look better. So maybe that's an inner feeling that I'm talking about.
While we're on the subject of age, you've had relationships with men considerably older and considerably younger than you. Does it make you feel differently about your old age, depending on the age of the man that you're involved with?
I used to think it would make me feel younger to be involved with a man who was much, much younger than me. And in fact, I have had relationships with younger men. I don't know whether the biographical, chronological age is the most important thing in a relationship. I don't know that it is. I think that I've thought a lot about that. People are not always the age that they appear to be. I have vast and boundless amounts of energy. I can dance all night and probably outdance most men who are 30. I'm really very energetic. So I don't know whether chronological age is the most important thing. I do think that maturity is important, and a certain kind of, I call it serenity, because it's come to me very late in life and I value it very highly. That's important, and maybe it takes a while to get that.
Novelist Erica Jong is my guest. You once described menopause as the great unspeakable subject. What do you mean?
I think it's true that people do not write about and do not talk about menopause in our culture. It's true there have been one or two books about it, but most women in America do not admit to ever going through menopause. The only one I can think of who's ever said a good word about it is Margaret Mead, who said all great things about it. But Margaret Mead is a role model and an inspiration to us all in so many different ways. She once did a study, I think, when she was about to have her daughter, and she had a daughter in her late 30s. Like so many accomplished women, she had a child in her late 30s. And she did a study, and she said that she went through biographies of prominent American women, and she discovered that many of them had had one child in their late 30s, often a daughter. But she was in the forefront of thinking about so many things because she had such an adventurous mind. And she praised the astounding energy of postmenopausal women. She's the only one you can find to say a good thing about it. But I think that's going to change in coming years, too.
Do you think this taboo about talking about menopause comes from women or comes from men?
Comes from both. I mean, in a misogynistic culture, both men and women are misogynistic. Often unconsciously, sometimes consciously.
Your novel, Fear of Flying, your first novel, which was published, what, in 74?
73.
It was one, I think it was part of the first wave of novels inspired by feminism. Did you have to, when you were getting started as a novelist, muddle through before you were able to find themes that you thought really related to women? Most of the big novelists of the time were men, let's face it.
My first novel had a male protagonist, and I was very lucky.
Was that never published?
My first novel was called The Man Who Murdered Poets, never published, because my publisher, a very smart man, said, this is a terrific novel, it's publishable, but don't publish it. Go home and write a novel with a female protagonist. This novel is very derivative, it sounds like Nabokov. Why don't you go home and write a novel that sounds like you? And I struggled a long time within myself to be able to write honestly out of a female consciousness. It was very hard for me. I went to college at a time when all the poets we studied as important poets were male. We studied Yeats. We studied Blake. We studied T.S. Eliot. Nobody even studied Emily Dickinson in my day at Barnard. Nobody studied Muriel Rukeyser. Nobody studied Marianne Moore except as a curiosity. It was as if the whole literary tradition was male. And we were the generation that began to change that. But we were very oppressed by those traditions.
One writer once said that, a woman once said that when she was in school and they were told, you know, that they had to have big themes, that it was understood like for men the big theme was jumping on a freight car and, you know, hitching across country and having adventures. And for women, adventure was having a sexual relationship with that man who was traveling around the country having other adventures.
I think one of the things that I did in my books was I changed that pattern because my heroes are all picaresque. My heroes or heroines are all picaresque. They go on journeys. They sometimes meet men who accompany them, but they are the travelers, they are the voyagers. And I think that really does break a pattern in the female novel. They don't stay home and just have love affairs.
You've also written a lot about sex. I mean, you describe sex. Your heroines have sex. Did you have to find a
Shocking,
language?
Shocking, isn't it?
It's horrible, isn't it? Did you have to find a language for describing sex in literature from a woman's perspective?
Yes.
What was the problem with the language you were used to reading
the
from
language,
men's novels?
The language is a male-dominated language. The language of sex is also the language of dirt and smut. You see, in a puritanical culture, the language that deals with the strong emotions, the language that deals with genitals, the language that deals with the act of copulation, is either filthy language suitable for scribbling on walls, and usually Anglo-Saxon words, or it's clinical and Latinate language that sounds like a textbook in medicine, not the language of strong emotion. So I had to take all those old Anglo-Saxon words, which Chaucer used, which Shakespeare used, which Rabelais used, and I had to cleanse them and create a new language out of them. Some people see these four-letter words on a page and they have a heart attack because they don't know that it's the same language that Shakespeare and Chaucer used, which I knew as a student of literature. But I tried to make that language new.
You had to find words that didn't make women's bodies sound ugly?
I had to try to write about women's bodies in an approving way. And I think I do write about women's bodies in an approving way. If you look at the last scene of Fear of Flying, Isadora is sitting in the bathtub looking down at the pink triangle between her thighs, looking down at the Tampax string fishing the water like a Hemingway hero, looking at the triangle of curly hair and saying, a nice body, mine, I decided to keep it. In Serenissima, Jessica loves her body. My women characters are very self-approving and very accepting, and I think that's one of the reasons that women like them and that men find them revealing.
The fact that women like their bodies in your novels, do you think a lot of women grow up disliking their bodies, being really uncomfortable with their bodies?
I think a lot of women dislike their bodies, and the culture approves their disliking their bodies. You would be surprised at how much stereotyping there is about women's bodies still, about women's smells, about women's aging, a subject again. You know, women over 40 are the butt of jokes. The idea that a woman exists in only one condition, she exists in the condition of youth. And if she's not young, then she's a joke. We can't approve women in every condition. I'm trying to change that very consciously with my writing, and I think I have begun to make inroads into changing that. I don't think that my daughter will have those attitudes. My daughter, let's hope, has a good attitude toward her body. She certainly seems to. She certainly likes herself.
You must be really conscious of trying to bring her up in a way that she will like herself.
Absolutely, and I really, it's really important to me that she does.
My guest is novelist Erica Jong. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Erica Jong. She's the author of Fear of Flying and Fanny. Her new book is a novel titled Serenissima. So many people read Fear of Flying, which was a bestseller, and I think one of the most memorable and still talked about moments or ideas in Fear of Flying is the idea of zipless sex, which is totally detached sex with a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a fantasy of yours when you wrote that? You've probably been asked about this so many times, I should apologize for asking you in advance.
I think the fantasy of having this perfect, beautiful sex with an anonymous person is a fantasy all of us have had. And it was very much in the air in 1973 when Fear of Flying was written. It seemed tremendously liberating. The perfect sex into which the world does not intrude. You don't know each other's names. You touch each other's bodies as if you've just come out of the Garden of Eden or you've just discovered each other for the first time. And it's idyllic, it's perfect, it's passionate. And of course, it doesn't exist in the real world. There is no such sex. It's a fantasy. But it's a fantasy that everybody has had, and I named it in Fear of Flying, and on my tombstone it will say, "Here lies the zipless Erica Jong."
Well, did women come up to you afterwards and say, "Oh, boy, you've really put it into words for me. I've always imagined
women,
that."
Women, men, children, dogs, animals, everybody has. I mean, when I wrote about that, I had no idea that it was so universal.
Did you go through asking yourself, is this a politically correct fantasy to have? What reaction will I get when I put it in the novel?
I was very aware when I was writing Fear of Flying that I was treading on everybody's toes, that I was politically incorrect in every way. I mean, and it was true when the book was published. Male chauvinists attacked it. Male chauvinists attacked it. Radical feminists attacked it as not radical enough. But I think that when you're a writer, you really have to do what D.H. Lawrence says, not listen to the didactic statements of the author, but listen to the low calling cries of the characters as they wander in the dark woods of their destiny. That's what Lawrence says. There was a great pull in me to kill off Isadora at the end, like Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina, or to get her knocked up and pregnant.
Punish her for
independence, for sex, which in fact happened to the heroines of most novels. Whether they were written by men or written by women, think of A Charmed Life by Mary McCarthy. The woman has a sexual affair and dies. It wasn't just male novelists like Tolstoy who killed off their independent heroines. Kate Chopin, in The Awakening, her heroine dies also for independence. Independence is seen only in a sexual form, and it is punishable by death. The heroine of Edna O'Brien's August is a Wicked Month, and I must say I admire Edna O'Brien tremendously. I think she's a wonderful writer. Her kid dies. The woman doesn't die, but the child dies because the mother reaches out for independence. So there's a very strong pull inside of the writer to fulfill the cultural stereotype and punish the woman for independence. And I think one of the things that's revolutionary about Fear of Flying and about my other books is that my heroines end on an up note. My heroines in every one of my books reach out for independence and are reborn. They don't die. Isadora is reborn through the bathtub. Isadora in How to Save Your Own Life is reborn in a new love affair. Fanny is reborn at the end of Fanny Hackabout Jones. She inherits Limeworth. She has a beautiful daughter. She ends up on a commune with the merry men tilling the soil. Jessica in Serenissima is reborn at the end of Serenissima and even gets a special bonus, which I can't tell you.
I won't give it away.
But I think my heroines always end up with a special plus and independence, too, and happy endings. I really believe in female independence.
Well, your characters are emotionally independent and sexually independent as well. There are so many sexually transmitted diseases going around now, the worst of which, of course, is AIDS. Do you think that that's bringing back the idea that people should be punished for sex?
Absolutely.
Just the kind of the idea you were trying to break in your novel.
Absolutely. And I think the media has jumped on AIDS with such glee. You would not, I mean, if AIDS didn't exist, it would have to be invented. It would have been invented by Jerry Falwell. I think it's amazing. I've seen posters in Greenwich Village that suggest that the Reagan administration has planted the AIDS virus in order to get rid of homosexuals and forward-thinking people. And I think that, you know, it's certainly a persuasive argument. I don't think that we will be able to do away with sexual freedom, the ideas of sexual freedom, through the AIDS epidemic. But I do think that our country is very puritanical and is looking for a way out of sexual freedom. I never really advocated numerical promiscuity in any of my books. I was packaged as if I had, but I really never, you know, never really wanted to promote promiscuity. As a person, I'm very particular about sex, and for me, sex should be connected with a relationship that includes warmth and love and friendship. And I'm very monogamous as a person. Maybe I'm serially monogamous, but I certainly am monogamous. And there's never been a time in my life when I've had a lot of lovers simultaneously. I can't concentrate on writing a novel and poems and magazine articles, loving a lot of men and raising a kid. It's all I can do to concentrate on my work, my kid, and one boyfriend.
You got a lot of flack, and I think it was difficult for you to get your Fear of Flying published and also marketed because of the sex scenes in it. There's a big debate within the women's movement now about whether there should be restrictions on sexually explicit materials that degrade women. I wonder where you stand on that.
I have read Andrea Dworkin with interest and admiration, and I think she's an important theorist, but I stand really opposite to her position. I think we have to have total freedom of the press, and I'm totally a libertarian on that issue, although I understand and I'm sensitive to that issue. And I think, obviously, I can't condone child molestation and snuff films. I think they're disgusting, but I think that every society gets the pornography it deserves. And the reason we have that pornography is because those are the attitudes towards women that we have. And also the attitudes towards children, let me point out, that we have, which are very destructive. And I think if we can change those attitudes, then we will no longer have those sorts of pornography. But that the pornography that we have reflects our misogynistic attitudes, and we have to change those attitudes.
Okay.
Censorship is not the answer, though.
My guest is novelist Erica Jong. You just said that a couple of minutes ago that you have been mostly monogamous, although it might have been serial monogamy. You've been married 3 times, I think. Is there still this stigma associated with that? Because it has the implication, like, 3 failed marriages. You know what I mean?
Don't think they're failed marriages. I think they were wonderful marriages. And I don't see them as failures anymore. I see them as journeys that I went on. And because I'm a woman who lived in a very free way and who lived in a way that I wanted to grow. I didn't want to be stagnated in different places in my life. And so I moved on. And I don't see them as failures at all. I think I had a wonderful relationship with the father of my daughter, Molly. I had a wonderful relationship with him. When Molly was born, we adored each other. We have become, after a pretty bad divorce, we've become friends again. I had a wonderful relationship with my first husband, who was my college partner and whom I lived with throughout my college years. And I outgrew that relationship for a lot of reasons, and so did he. I had a pretty good relationship with Alan Jong, my psychiatrist's second husband, whose name I bear. And it was, when it ended, it ended. And I've been very blessed. I've had a lot of wonderful men in my life, but I don't see them as failures, really. And I think you can't be an interesting woman in these turbulent times and not have been through different stages of your life. I wish that I could have been married to one person for 25 years, but for various reasons, it wasn't in the cards for me. I outgrew these relationships, or they just stopped working. And rather than die and stagnate, I moved on. But I don't see them as failures.
With that attitude, would you get married again? Do you think that officialness of marriage is important?
Jessica Pruitt says she agrees with Gloria Steinem in that she can't mate in captivity. The heroine of Serenissima says, my heart always leapt in assent when Gloria Steinem said she had never been married because she couldn't mate in captivity. And there's a part of me that says, don't mate in captivity. There's another part of me that says, how cozy, how nice to come home to the same person every night, how nice to share everything with somebody and to be married and settled. Although, you know, I think being settled is an illusion. For a person who's a poet, who's a quester, who's out for a picaresque life, maybe there is no such thing as being settled. I might get married again. I have been discussing it with the man I'm with now. We've mentioned the dreaded M word, but I don't know.
I just have one other thing I want to ask you. Do you agree? You have a daughter who's 8 now. Do you agree with women who say that the women's movement didn't address parents, didn't address mothers as strongly as it should have?
I think that the women's movement seemed to alienate women who wanted to have babies at a certain point. At a certain point in its history, and I would say the early 70s, it seemed that women who were in rebellion against the feminine mystique seemed to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Now, I know that this was not all feminists, but it must have seemed to a lot of mainstream women who were raising their 3 children in their houses in the suburbs that the feminist movement had nothing to tell them because the feminist movement was not giving value to their lives, which were spent loving children. I think that has been remedied in the last few years.
Okay. Erica Jong, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer Erica Jong, whose novels include Fear of Flying and Serenissima. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Lynn Harrell, one of today's leading cellists. Here's a sample of his playing from his recording of the Bach cello suites. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with playwright Adrienne Kennedy. Her new memoir chronicles her life from growing up black and middle class in Cleveland to becoming one of Off-Broadway's few black women playwrights. Also, singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne perform a few of their favorite songs from Vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the new home video, The Masters of Comic Book Art, which profiles some of today's most innovative comic book artists. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Today on our weekly performance spot, we'd like to introduce you to singer-songwriter Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne. They're married and share a passion for ragtime blues, Tin Pan Alley, and vaudeville songs. They include many of these songs in their repertoire, and they're going to do a couple for us today.
We're going to start with a song that was written in 1929, right on the eve of the Great Depression. And it has that kind of buoyancy and optimism people needed so much during those hard years.
I'm not a poet, how well I know it. I've never been a raver. But when I speak of you, I rave a bit, it's true. I'm wild about you, I'm lost without you. You give my life its flavor. What sugar does for tea, that's exactly what you do. Salt in my stew, you will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you. You're the starch in my collar, you're the lace in my shoe. You will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you. Dovetails. You've heard each known way, but this way is my own way. You're the sail in my love boat. You're the captain and crew. You will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you.
The old songs we choose to sing are always songs that have some kind of relevance to life today. And here's a little slice of what you might call feminism from the 1920s. It's all about the double standard.
Said Mr. Jiggs to Mrs. Jiggs, I gotta go out tonight. Said Mrs. Jiggs to Mr. Jiggs, why, honey, it's quite all right. Don't be afraid to grieve me. Be on your way. I know you hate to leave me, but it's okay. You gotta go out. You got a big date, you gotta go out, you're coming home late, and so is your old lady. You got a sick friend who's gotta be watched, you're taking along a bottle of scotch, and so is your old lady. And while while you're telling some baby you're lonesome. Don't think I'm home by my own some. You're getting too gay, getting too hot. You're getting away with a terrible lot. And so is your old lady. Take it away.
Singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne, they're based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but spend most of their time on the road making appearances around the country. Their latest album is called Pulling Through on the Green Linnet label. We'll hear more from Jane and Hoyle later on this summer. Listening to Fresh Air. My guest is playwright Adrian Kennedy. She's written her memoir called People Who Led to My Plays. It's about growing up in a black middle-class family in Cleveland and all the books, movies, and people who influenced her on her way to becoming a playwright. Kennedy studied playwriting with Edward Albee in New York, and he produced her first successful play, Funny House of a Negro. The play won an Obie Award in 1964. Kennedy was an integral part of the avant-garde off-Broadway theater movement of the 60s. Her plays were being produced by Joseph Papp and La Mama Experimental Theater. Like her plays, she's written her memoir in an unconventional form. It's a scrapbook of memories, each reflection given its own paragraph and title. When I spoke with Adrian Kennedy, I asked her why she took this time to look back on her life.
I felt that I was losing these people, and I really don't want to lose them, because I think about them all the time, and I really did not want to lose these people, and I felt it's about time I tried to get them down. It was about time.
I'm going to ask you to read several entries from your memoir and discuss them. Can we start with Jack and Jill?
Mm-hmm. Jack and Jill went up a hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after. "What's a crown?" I asked my mother. "His head," she said.
You know, I always wondered that, too. When I heard Jack and Jill, I had no idea what a crown was. But in reading your book, it struck me that you were probably much more attuned to language and to words that you didn't understand, and you probably really needed to understand those words.
Well, I remember sitting in the kitchen with my mother with the nursery rhymes, you know, in front, the book in front of me, and I would always ask her many, many questions. And that's that image of sitting in the kitchen, maybe before dinner, asking my mother questions about the nursery rhymes.
Another entry I want you to read, Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire after seeing their movies.
Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire after seeing their movies. Gracefulness must be sought. It's possible the sublime could exist in your daily life. That means a lot to me because many times Ohio or Cleveland seemed dark to me. And Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies really just inspired me. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could just dance through life like that?
Is one of the reasons that you loved movies and books because they became a way of getting the sublime into your ordinary life?
Very much so. I'm not sure why, but I always felt that Cleveland was far away from anything exotic or romantic. And of course, we always went to the movies on Saturday afternoon. Every kid in our school went to the movies on Saturday afternoon. It was called the Waldorf. And those people were just a total symbol of the sublime.
Even the name of the movie theater.
Yes. You know, they were very fancy then, even the neighborhood movie theater. One was called the Waldorf and the other one was called the Imperial. So you can imagine.
Could you read the entry called Negroes?
Negroes. We were underdogs and underdogs must fight in life.
Were there certain occasions where your parents would sit you down and talk to you about how Negroes had to work extra hard because they were underdogs?
My parents believed that intensely, that American blacks have to really work 100% in order to get recognition or the credit that we deserve, very much so.
So you became quite an achiever in school.
Extremely. I was extremely competitive, and I wanted to get all A's, all gold stars, all silver stars. It's very important to me, very important to my parents also.
Could you read Miss Edwards about your eighth grade teacher?
Yes. Miss Edwards. My eighth grade English teacher taught Shelley, Keats, Byron, Wordsworth. The words poetic, lyrical, romantic suggested that writers led meaningful, significant lives. And as they expressed sorrow and great happiness, they were still often misfits, at odds with society, thoughts a 13-year-old Negro girl responded to.
You know, I think a lot of people respond to artists and to the arts because they feel like outsiders themselves.
Yes. It seems to me at 12, I guess like a lot of people, I felt quite miserable. And it was just wonderful to hear that these people felt like outsiders, and that they were always fighting society. That was very comforting, extremely comforting.
And that made you want to be a writer?
I wasn't aware of it, of course, at that age, but I think images of writers rebelling and writers being exiles and writers criticizing society was something that really, really took hold in my imagination.
Another entry. My dorm mates at Ohio State College.
My dorm mates at Ohio State. Often from southern Ohio towns, they were determined to subjugate the Negro girls. They were determined to make you feel it was a great inequity that they had to live in the same dorm with you, an injustice. This dark reality was later to give great impetus and energy to my dreams.
How did that give impetus to your dreams?
It made me angry. It made me angry because there were 13, most of the time I was at Ohio State, 4 years, there were usually between 8 and 13 Negro girls in the dorm. And there were about 600 girls in the dorm, so you can imagine. I mean, we were a tiny, tiny bunch. And people were just quite cruel. They took it quite for granted. And it just made me angry, and I think very often I said to myself, one day I'm going to show them. One day I'm going to prove that these people are not superior to me, no matter how much they try to pretend they are. It made me very, very angry.
Coming from an ethnically mixed neighborhood, were you unprepared for the kind of discrimination you found in college?
I was unprepared for it. Glenville was the high school I went to, I guess, was about half Jewish, and the rest was a mixture of black and other nationalities. I'm not sure whether it was an illusion, but we were competitive, but yet we seemed to mingle quite freely together. And I was unprepared for the kind of separate thing that Negroes were in at Ohio State. I was very unprepared for it.
I get the impression that you're actually a very shy person in many ways. And if that's true, I'm sure that didn't help in in trying to break into a field as competitive as the theater.
I've never understood that contradiction about myself because I am shy. At the same time, I'm also a very determined person, and I'm not really sure how it really fits in, except that I am a person who can send my manuscript to 12 million publishers, and it's, you know, rejected by all 12 million, or 12 million producers. And that seems to somehow compensate for my shyness.
Do you think you were looked at as being an unusual creature because you were a black woman playwright? And that we're talking about the mid-60s here, or the early 60s.
You know, at the time, I mean, you know, first, you know, there was Lorraine Hansberry, and there were a small group of women playwrights, I think, you know, Megan Terry, Rosalind Drexler. There were a small group. I think I thought of myself as an off-Broadway playwright in those days, and an off-Broadway playwright, when I started to have plays at La Mama. I think that's how I defined myself, and that's what gave me a sense of security. And those were the people that I ended up talking to on the telephone or seeing, or those were the people that I got grants with. And I think that's what really gave me my definition at the time.
Part of your story is about being a black middle-class girl coming of age. And I wonder if you think that in many ways the lives of black middle-class people have been underdocumented.
I feel that very strongly. It's very funny that you should say that. I have very strong feelings about that. Because there are many black middle-class people in America, and yet they have been underdocumented. These are just people who are hardworking, get up every day, go to work, save their money, push their kids to do well. It's mysterious to me why our lives haven't been written about more. It's quite mysterious.
Well, Adrienne Kennedy, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I really want to thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
Adrienne Kennedy's memoir is called People Who Led to My Plays. She spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, today, Casper Weinberger got his turn to testify before
the
Iran-Contra hearings.
He followed Donald Regan to the witness stand, and we'll have a report on both there. Testimony today. Also on events in Sri Lanka, where there are now Indian troops there to enforce an agreement between Sri Lanka and India aimed at ending civil strife in that island country.
Any features to preview that pertain to the upcoming weekend?
Yes. Here's a leisure story for the weekend. Celeste Wesson, our intrepid reporter in Los Angeles, reports on a new line of romance videos. You've heard of Harlequin romance books? Now videos.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Remember getting yelled at for reading comic books when you were supposed to be doing your homework? Maybe you grew up in the wrong era. In the past several years, more people have started taking comic books seriously. A new home video release looks at comic book art through the eyes of its creators. Critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Here is the wonderfully simple idea of a new video cassette called The Masters of Comic Book Art. Take 10 modern cartoonists and allow them to explain themselves while showing examples of their art. Director Ken Viola has rounded up artists such as Mad Magazine pioneer Harvey Kurtzman, Marvel Comics innovator Jack Kirby, and Art Spiegelman, creator of the comic strip novel Mouse. All of these and more spend an hour chatting about the place of the cartoonist in the worlds of both art and commerce. One problem presents itself immediately, narrator Harlan Ellison. Sprawled on a sofa, tucking his little expensive loafers under his considerable bulk, Ellison emits puffery and cliches. His presence is not only annoying, it's unnecessary. Viola's notion of letting the cartoonists explain themselves while flashing us bits of their comic books makes all of Ellison's time-consuming prattle irrelevant. Here, for example, is Art Spiegelman making a quietly impassioned speech about the potential of comic book art.
Since all we're really talking about is we're talking about words and pictures, they're plastered together somehow, a structure's made of those words and pictures, and that can contain a comics equivalent to Beethoven as well as a comics equivalent to Van Halen. It's open. All it really is a medium, and then it becomes as strong, as potent as the artists within it. And I'd like to see it move away from genre fiction. I'd like to see it move away from obsessive recapitulation of the same fantasies over and over again. So on the one hand, I'd like to see subject matter more reflective of what people's actual situations are. I'd like to see it grapple with more difficult moral and political issues. I'd like to see it deal with more personal issues throughout. And I'd like to see it develop aesthetically. I'd like to see people whose background isn't so solely drawn from comic books, that all that can be spit back is more comic books.
Ken Viola does a first-rate job of reproducing the art. The colors are bright and vivid. The details are sharply defined. The camera pans across whole pages of comic books, so we get a sense of the flow and energy of the best comic book art, as well as an eyeful of the gleefully exaggerated drawing. As with all artists, some are more articulate than others. People without a sense of comic book history, for example, might not realize from Harvey Kurtzman's halting, modest comments what a groundbreaking artist he really is. On the other hand, Frank Miller, the young artist who revitalized Batman for the 80s, is a real windbag. He's the sort of excellent artist who's ashamed to be working in pop culture and so ties himself in knots trying to justify his existence. Arriving at a time of increased serious interest in the validity of this medium, The Masters of Comic Book Art is a worthy and entertaining addition to scholarship in this field. If only someone had put one of those loafers in Harlan Ellison's mouth. Other new video cassette releases include Crocodile Dundee, one of those rare blockbuster comedies that's actually pretty funny, and Black Widow, a complicated black comedy directed by complicated Bob Rafelson and starring those complicated actresses Deborah Winger and Teresa Russell.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with John Kelleher, the producer and co-writer of the new film Eat the Peach. It's about two motorcyclists who ride a wall of death. Also, jazz critic Francis Davis will review the new edition of the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. This 7-record set features performances ranging from Jelly Roll Morton to the World Saxophone Quartet. And guest TV critic Pat Ofterheide will review two documentaries airing on public television that profile atom bomb survivors in Japan. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WMRA, in Harrisonburg, Virginia. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who directed today's show. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.